director here of the Meter Center for Calvin Studies. It's my great pleasure to welcome all of you here this afternoon for this special presentation. We are delighted to welcome Dr. Anya Sylvia Goeing here. She received her PhD in history from the University of Würzburg in 1999, and she has taught and been a postdoctoral fellow at various institutions, including the Helmut Schmidt University in Hamburg, the University of Zurich. She's also spent time in California at the California Institute of Technology, and she is currently a visiting fellow at Harvard University. Her topic for us today is Teaching Physics, the 16th Century Meditations on the Nature of Evidence. Anya.
Thank you for the introduction. And before I start, I just wanted to show you where we are going. Of course, you are all very familiar with Switzerland, since this is Calvin College. But I have one little sentence for you, and you will see after a minute that it's completely wrong. The year is 1555, and all Europe is occupied. Only one small territory of indomitable Swiss still holds out against the invaders. So that will be asterisk and obelisk. And what we know about Swiss history is that even though Switzerland is so small and the Holy Roman Empire is so big and France on the other side is also so big, they are not pressing Switzerland between them. It's the other way around. They are more or less negligible to Switzerland. And that is the reason why the Swiss Confederation had a bit of more autonomy, and then after the 30-year war could be accepted as its own confederate state. I am talking about one town in Switzerland. Let's see. How do I get?
I think you just
further
on the. Let's see.
Ah, something
sure
happens. Yes, yes.
This one, you good?
Yeah.
Yep, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So that one there. Yep.
So, you see here. It's a very precarious balance between confessionalized Catholic and Protestant states. I don't want to go into detail here, but we have on the one side Zurich, Basel, Bern, and on the other side Lucerne, Fribourg, and other Catholic order, that is territories. And I will be talking about one very big territory, that is here, Zurich. A lot of you have been there, I'm sure. Let's see. This is how it looks today. And I have found some old pictures. It's not that far from how it looked in the 16th century. This is the dome,
Osminster.
And everything that concerning the school is behind the dome. There was a little house, and in this house, behind the dome, the preachers, the professors, and the students would meet to have their lessons. One of the professors in Zurich was Konrad Gesner, and he is very famous nowadays because he's always seen as the one with the most encyclopedias in the 16th century. So he created encyclopedias about natural history, and he was teaching Aristotelian ethics and physics at the so-called Zurich Lectorium, a theological seminary that had as its bigger goal the teaching of the new Protestant faith to students who then would become ministers in Zurich. So I will start here. When Konrad Gesner wrote his Zurich textbook on book two of the Aristotelian Doctrine of the Soul in 1563, the structure of this 232-page work was important for him as an aid for the students reading it. This is documented in his final note, in which he states that his book will not need an index because it is well organized and therefore does not need auxiliary material for reading. The book was addressed to students of physics, philology, and medicine. It was created in conjunction with efforts to reorganize the Zurich Lectorium in 1559-1560 in line with a new teaching and administrative concept. Among other things, this new concept called for the professor of physics to compile his introductory texts himself. From 1541 until his death in 1565, Konrad Gesner was not only a town physician in Zurich, but also the only professor of natural philosophy at the Zurich Lectorium, where he also taught Aristotelian ethics from 1548 to 1559. Zurich students attended his course on the soul at the age of around 16. After they had successfully passed the Latin school and were accepted to the lectorium to undertake further studies in rhetoric and dialectic, Greek, natural philosophy, ethics, and in particular theology. This commentary comprises a general introduction to contemporary theses on the soul and leads to a discussion of the senses, of the internal and external senses that Gesner classifies according to his own criteria, the five external senses, the sense of touch, taste, smell, hearing, and sight, are given an especially extensive treatment in the order named here in their own chapters. Since in the secondary literature on the history of science, Gesner's encyclopedias serve to show the foundations of contemporary organizations of knowledge, and since Gesner's De Anima consists mainly of all kinds of lists organized under headings to illustrate overarching points of view, the next step of this investigation are directed to know more about it. With the help of Gesner's textbook, it is possible to identify the significance of his systems for organizing knowledge and their function for instruction. I would like to show in this talk that Gesner's De Anima is a so-called printed commonplace book or collection of loci that is therefore part of a specific tradition with rhetorical roots. I would like to show as well that this organizing information overload in encyclopedias and abridged textbooks, following the rules of certain kinds of commonplace books, is only one side of the coin if one wants to understand Gesner's cosmos. Other than his unloved colleague at Paris, Petrus Ramus, Gesner combined the organization of concepts with informed self-study, in which the touch of the physician and search for evidence stands like the touch of St. Thomas the Apostle into the bound of Christ, hierarchically over just seeing or hearing of it. Gesner himself assigns his textbook the function of a repetitorium, a review book, and thus alludes to the field of applied mnemotechnics or the art of memory. In so doing, Gesner creates a connection. Teaching and learning in this case comes to stand between his commentary on Aristotle and developments in the field of rhetoric. These developments consist mainly in the collection of loci or commonplaces. In the last instance, they go back to the reception of textbooks that were widely read in the Middle Ages, Rhetorica ad Herennium, Cicero's early work De Inventione, and the Progymnasmata, written by Greek orator Aphtonius, as preliminary exercises of rhetoric in the 4th century. The paper is arranged as follows. After a report about the state of the art, referring to secondary literature on teaching and learning, and an introduction to the idea of the loci collections, which focuses on De Copia by Erasmus, I will undertake an analysis of De Anima to show if Gesner's De Anima is a printed form of commonplace book for school purposes. Only in very, very recent times have the organizational forms of how to cite and how to excerpt in the 16th century become the subject of independent research into the history of knowledge. In her dissertation, The Theater of Nature, Jean Baudin and Renaissance Science, and Blair, working with the books of Physics Universae Naturae Theatrum by Jean Baudin and published in 1596, draws attention to structures in the text that allow one to assume the texts from old and ancient books had been dissected, taken apart. The most important survey of the different fields in which the loci collections were applied is provided by Anne Moss in her 1996 book, Printed Commonplace Books and the Structuring of Renaissance Thought. As Moss observes, the works by classical authors that were nearly untouchable in scholastic times and beginning humanism, first and foremost Cicero and Aristotle, were dissected at the start of modernity in the second half of the 15th century, especially in schools in which students were made to memorize adaptable phrases. Single sentences were removed and organized under headings and collections of quotations. The generic terms were primarily taken from the works of Aristotle. After that, they were researched individually, and finally they were applied and organized by means of new, highly thought-out approaches to dialectic, as in the work of Wittenberg scholar Philip Melanchthon and Paris professor Petrus Ramos. These loci collections were started in school and in many cases pursued by the scholar until his old age. Although Moss stated that the later use of structured and printed commonplace books in schools from 1560 was most frequent, she does not describe their different function, which could not have consisted, at least in so far as the book was in the hand of students, not of teachers, in the compilation of commonplace words, since these compilations were already made. For this reason, she also does not discuss the statutes of repetitoria or exercises in class. In his 2007 book, Commonplace Learning, Ramism and its German Ramifications, which treats loci collections as Petrus Ramus and his followers have thought about them, Howard Hodgson alludes to one case in 1582 at the University of Leiden, in which six students asked to read Aristotle again in the original and without Ramus Compendia. The Senate accepted this petition and reintroduced the unabridged lecture of Aristotle in class. Theoretical or pedagogical motives for the debate are not reported. Highly suggestive in this regard is the book that Lina Bolzoni published in 1995 under the title La Stanza della Memoria. It was translated into English in 2001. Bolzoni illustrates her first chapter with a tree diagram, which is roughly viewable over there, that rhetoric professor Francesco Robertello produced for the Accademia Veneziana. He used the diagram to visually represent his course on rhetoric in this institution. Robertello published the diagram in 1549 in Venice with a Latin subtitle that has been translated into English by the Bolzoni's translator, Jeremy Partson. I quote, "In hope of a successful result, Francesco Robertello from Udine who by order of the scholastic authorities will teach a course on rhetoric in Venice this year based on the ancient rhetoricians, offers this table to his listeners for their perusal. All things that have to do with the art of speech, from Cicero to Quintilian, Hermogenes, or Aristotle, have been positioned in the place of the table. Anyone can consult it and thus can know the origin of every question and the heading to which one must refer. In this way, every time a controversy arises in interpretation, all that can be disputed about it will be readily identifiable in its place. Robertello suggests that consultation of his table will indicate the terms of the objects that comprise the entire field of rhetoric. Should the listener of his lecture find himself in the predicament of having to compose an oration for a debate, he will have access to the entire contents by following the structure of the headings. The designated fields of reference and the necessary information can be easily identified and found. The table provides quick orientation for students. With this example, Lina Bolzoni shows that students were able to follow the teacher's voice and words at every moment of the lecture by looking at the diagram. Consequently, they were able to find each term easily in the network of relations. Through this method, knowledge could be used again and again without any further input by the student. Bolzoni's statements show how large the didactical distance could be between the student's collection and production of commonplace books and the teacher's distribution of commonplace books that they themselves have made. Knowledge was handled in quite different ways and with very different goals. In the first case, classical texts and text fragments were mnemonically adapted and accommodated to the proper roster of terms and headings, and in the second, there was a ready-made use of arguments or phrases. The recourse to classical texts was rendered obsolete. Bolzoni does not draw any conclusions from her observation, but moves on to the next point, which concerns the senseless composition of orations by rhetorical machines capable of mixing ready-made phrases in multifaceted variations. She leaves it to the reader to imagine how humanism could develop into mere senselessness, starting with the sage work by authors such as Quintilian or Cicero, moving to loci collections and culminating in the preposterous phrase threshing machine. Come to my second chapter. In his 1530 work De Copia on the abundance of style, Erasmus of Rotterdam describes two aspects of collecting loci and commonplace books. First, the collection of words, verba, or the eloquent and well-chosen expressions used in letters, replacing the collection of formula used in his times, and second, the aspect of res, which entails explaining what is comprised by an entire proposition or sentence, translatable perhaps as thought. Erasmus distinguishes the two areas as follows. In the first part of his book, he recommends that in order to compose fluent and more eloquent letters, his readers, ideally students of rhetoric, should generate a list of expressions or phrases under headings that can be used when they have the opportunity in the future. His many examples in support of his claim can be quite amusing, since they show letter headings and salutations developed ad absurdum. The English translation by Betty Knott reads, "Let us, quote, for example, take this sentence. Your letter pleased me mightily. It is transformed into, how delighted I was to read your letter. The perusal of your letter charmed my mind with singular delight. As a result of your letter, I was affected with singular gladness, the variations, and with 53 tones, and with, as a result of your letter, I was affected with singular, no. Could I possibly compare Attic Honey with your dear letter? And your lines seem to me pure enchantment. In 53 variations, Erasmus demonstrates the possibilities of an abundant style of changing statements in a nuanced way and expressing the same content with different words. In the second part of his work, Erasmus expands the application field of the collected examples by adding the world of facts, themes, and modes of argumentation. He calls both parts explicitly verba and res, the first part verba due to its emphasis on words, and the second due to its concern with concepts. According to Erasmus, in the area of res, students must first examine each of the many examples and possibilities in order to decide how they can formulate the best possible argument and adapt it to the situation. Erasmus concludes that the exercise of collecting and applying these phrases will train the memory over time and enable students to find the correct pattern easily and quickly. Erasmus dedicated this book in 1512 to St. Paul's School in London. He had written it long before, but had never finished yet. He only agreed to have it printed first in 1512 in London when faced with the threat of a non-authorized print of one of the associated manuscripts. The following enhanced edition, which I have used, was printed in Strasbourg in 1513 and Basel in 1514. Until 1572, as Herbert Ricks noted in 1946, there were 150 editions of the book printed by the famous printing shops of Northern Europe, including those in Antwerp, Basel, Leipzig, London, Lyon, Paris, Cologne, and Strasbourg. Unfortunately, we do not know how large the print runs of the individual editions were, yet we can assume, on the basis of the large number of editions, that the book was disseminated throughout Europe. It was also recommended and prescribed for teaching in Zurich. Proof of this can be found in the Zurich School Regulations of 1559. Erasmus de Copia was part of the fifth form's curriculum in the Upper Latin School. According to the plan, the book was to be read before Gesner's Aristotelian Physica, but we do not know if this plan was implemented. We know from the study by Urs Loy that there was no great step between the collection of quotes recommended by Erasmus and the registers forming the basis for Conrad Gesner's encyclopedias. Both are comparable in forming generic terms, but both are not completely the same or perfect mirrors of each other. The applied method of Erasmus is seen especially in Northern Europe, if not as point of departure, so at least as a reason of distribution of a determined form to gather quotes under headers in notebooks. These notebooks are called topoi books, loci books, or simple commonplace books, according to the kind of collection referring to header terms, the so-called loci or topoi. They find their entrance in all fields of occupation with knowledge, especially in school. And Moss used the example of the school treatise De Literarum Ludis Recte Aperiendis by Johannes Sturm as of 1538, to show that students were directly guided to create notebooks like this. I cite the translation by Louis Spitz and Barbara Sher Tinsley of 1995. Quote, "These three grades, the 9th, 8th, and 7th, require training the memory. Even material which they have already learned once must be repeated as at brief intervals, often and regularly. The perceptions of the mind become clearer, the faculty of recall becomes brighter, and the discovery and use of each are easier if they may be divided up according to certain common criteria, limb by limb, as it were, and by short phrases, and collected under general headings, so that what the orderly mind itself can recite from memory, it may also know where to find the same information divided neatly into its basic components. For just as cosmographers' maps, which depict the very places we once frequented strongly, excite us and enlighten our perceptions, so even desolate expanses are put into order when we grasp them with the mind. The first three grades, until children reached the age of eight or nine, were mainly dedicated to exercises of the mind. Sturm recommended separating the subject taught by the teacher into small parts, such as sentences, and collecting it under subject headings, loci. This division does not allow memory to learn these sentences, as Robert Teller suggests at the beginning of the paper, but rather it enables a contrary person to keep the sentences and find them again, if necessary. This kind of map, which Sturm asks his students to learn, is therefore a reflection of the content of the memory in an ideal form. We find commonplace or loci books en masse in the archives, published from the late 16th century onward. A good example is the loci book by Francis Bacon in London, a collection of interesting sentences without order or headings, and, on the other hand, the well-organized Topoi book on Physica from 1598. The latter is held in the Genevan Library with the school papers and personal effects of Theodore Tronchia. Tronchia, who was elected rector of the Genevan Academy 12 years later, was just 16 when he started the book using quotes from Aristotelian physics, ethics, and economy. From the second half of the 16th century onward, the use of topoi books with hierarchical heading systems, like the one developed by Francesco Robertello, was regarded as a trademark of the schools and modes of thought influenced by Reimers, especially in Reformed Protestant regions. As Howard Hodgson reports, in 1576, the year he was in office, Altdorf rector Thomas Frigius composed and printed the textbooks in all subjects, grammar, rhetoric, dialectic, physics, etc., according to Reimers. They were completely removed from the curriculum already in 1592. Scholars of dialectic engaged in a separate, lively discussion on the compilation of generic terms. The most important dialectic considerations regarded the compilation of generic terms stem from Philip Melanchthon and Petrus Ramus. Wittenberg professor Philip Melanchthon altered and re-edited his opinion on the connection between rhetoric and dialectic several times between 1520 and his death in 1560. In relation to Melanchthon, Tons Loci Communes, Volkhard Welz demonstrated in his 2008 study on dialectic that, according to Melanchthon, basic axiomatic sentences of each subject doctrine function as loci communes, since they serve as the most important foundation for the deduction of specific subordinate clauses. They therefore demarcate the group of generally accepted true sentences from which all subordinate clauses are deduced. The book by Melanchthon differs in terms and contents from books on rhetoric. His goal was not to present under generic terms an abundance of words and thoughts for memorization and thus to enable the reader to produce better texts. Rather, he was concerned with introducing and teaching basic theological or foundational sentences. On the other hand, Petrus Ramus, a student of Johannes Sturm and a professor in Paris, began after 1540 to construct his dialectic based on premises from verbal reasoning. Walter Ong, whose 1958 book Reimers' Method and the Decay of Dialect continues to be held in high esteem today, describes Reimers' approach as follows. I quote, "The training in dialectic, from which the later dialectic emerges, is a curious document and can be described as an attempt to set a vaguely Agricolan dialectic in a Ciceronian psychology, to give it a Platonic surface, purportedly in the interests of religion, and to simplify the result for reasons of practice or pedagogical expediency. End of quote. Summarized very briefly, Ramus assumes that the art of dialectic must imitate a natural dialectic or mode of disputing that is open to every school child, even without the need for training. This natural dialectic has nothing to do with Aristotelian prescripts. Physician and naturalist Theodor Zwinger was active in Basel in the age of Konrad Gesner. In 1565, he used the approach proposed by Ramus for his tables and diagrams, as Paul Michel discusses extensively in his 2007 essay. Ironically, Zwinger's tree diagrams do not allow us to retrieve a term once it is stored in the system. Michel shows this using one entry as an example, on the effects of the function of the human mind, that is the entry. The diagram belonging to this head row takes up 12 folio pages. The content referred to by the diagram fills the following 84 folio pages. The primary loci are affirmative, negative, sure, unsure, whole, part, etc. The subordinate terms continue with similar criteria. Examples of loci in the middle of the hierarchy are simple composite. Ultimately, any search for terms using these loci is doomed to failure. Try to search for the whale in this kind of universe of sure, unsure, and affirmative, negative. It's not possible anymore. In Zurich, there was very little scholarly debate concerning the makeup of loci. In his 1548 work, Pandekta, which contained a collection of bibliographic entries organized according to school or university subjects and their subgroups, Konrad Gesner defined what he understood by the term loci communes. As Osloy has written, Gesner suggests collecting loci and examples according to the method described by Erasmus in the second book of De Copia. Gesner provides the reader with an example of these loci collections. As he writes in his introduction, Pandekta presents a single collection of loci arranged by subject and subordinate subject. Pandekta is organized as follows. First, the area of knowledge beyond school and university subjects are separated. The subject physica follows in extensive bibliographical descriptions of the subjects grammatica, dialectica, rhetorica, poetica, arithmetica, geometria, musica, astronomia, astrologia, divinazione, geographia, historia, and artis illiteratis. Physica is followed by metaphysica, further Aristotelian writings, and the university subjects of law, medicine, and theology. Every subject has subordinate loci that divide the specific areas. Physica, for example, is arranged according to the books by Aristotle. The locus or titulus 9 treats the anima. Registers of places were made, ranging from the general to the specific, and the chapter numbers of books are indicated with statements on subordinate topics. Hence, hearing, the audito, is listed with the following information. It's the audito, Plutarchus, and then De Placidis, Plinius, 722, Brosonius, 117, Lumen Anima, Titulus, 52, De Auribus, Problemata Aristotelis, Sectionis, 13. So he gives direct bibliographical advice where to find more about his locus or his loci. First, the subtopics are given, in this case the audito and the auribus, then the author, a short title of the book, and the chapter number. In the specific case of Konrad Gesner, The question posed at the beginning concerning the use of printed loci collections at school leads to a new piece of information. Gesner does not provide readers of his Pandekta with quotes in order to allow them to reconstruct a narration as quickly as possible, as Robertello wanted. Rather, he gives information on the passages in different books to search for. Readers of Pandekta are indirectly prompted to search for the quote themselves. They now consult the original text with Gesner's advice and excerpt the searched for content. Here the focus is clearly on the engagement with literature, not on the quick recreation of a piece of writing or oration. While Pandekta works with differences, with references to other passages in books, Gesner's De Anima is a different type of work. Like Pandekta, it is a loci book, but it can be read without consulting Aristotle's De Anima. The structure of De Anima can hardly be compared to that of Pandekta. The main difference is the reading direction from front to back, which is shown by the fact that the heading terms and the subgroups is one entire sentence that builds upon the previous subgroup heading term, also a sentence. It is always expanded and differentiated by the list of entries beneath it. This will be shown in the following chapter. In contrast to his encyclopedia, but not to the above-mentioned Pandekta, Gesner does not use alphabetically arranged chapters in his textbook, but structures them according to the objects under discussion, moving from the general to the specific. After an initial general section, he explains the five external senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch, but in inverse order. Unlike Aristotle, Gesner reorganizes the succession of the senses. He starts with the sense of touch and then addresses taste, smell, and hearing before discussing sight. His reason for this new order is extensively elaborated and has to do with the textbook's repetitious character. I quote, "Aristotle deals first with the sense of sight, then with hearing, smell, taste, and even later with touch. The reason is that if we follow the method of learning and teaching, there are many more difficulties with the sense of touch than with the sense of sight. But since we are not so much concerned about the new, but rather wish to repeat, digest, and practice what we have found in Aristotle's work and those of others, nothing forbids us to proceed in an opposite order, from the first and the most necessary sense of touch as the first fact, alongside the others in the middle, to the sense of sight." Gesner deviated explicitly from a didactical path that put the sense of touch at the end, and for additional didactical reasons, chose the opposite order for the chapters in his writing. He strives to review material with his students, to digest and practice it, meaning he does not break new ground in the discussion of the subject. He therefore starts with what is necessary and most obvious. The list with which Gesner works in different places have different aspects in this book. Whereas the first general section consists nearly without exception of numbered lists, aphorisms, and superordinate sentences, the lists in the second part resemble patterns of encyclopedias. The chapters on the single senses in the second part are structured similarly, but differ from the first part. Gesner creates subgroups with the same name that explain the function of all the senses in greater detail. They serve to organize the entries and facilitate comparison. Even in the entries, Gesner compares organs and functions. In concrete terms, these categories include first a description of the organ, then of the medium or carrier of the sensory perception, and finally of the object that is comprised by the sense. He includes the distinguishing qualities attributable to the sense, that is, the contribution it makes to allowing us to perceive the world. In the case of the tactile sense, for example, this contribution consists of allowing us to distinguish between the simplest elements of the touch object, such as warmth, coldness, humidity, and aridity, in the case of hearing, first the ear is discussed, then the sound as its object and air as its medium. In this case, the modus is an assembly of different characteristics of sound in tables. A look at the description of the organ shows the type of reasoning. I translate that. On hearing. Hearing is the potential to perceive sounds in the auditory organs via the medium of air or water. Then we have here in the margin organum, the other things I wrote there, you should not read. The authors do not agree about the organs associated with hearing. Some people say that this is simply the ear, but this term signifies only the earlobe. The outstanding part, however, that is given not so much for hearing in general, but for hearing better to the four-footed animals, and not to all, but to those who give birth to living creatures, and moreover as an ornament, especially for the human being. Just now it lays clearly open that the inner channel is in the blood to all equipped and more perfect beings. But the question remains, which simple part of the ears or ear canals have the potential to hear, as is the case of the pupil in the eye? Gesner states briefly and without mentioning names that there were different opinions about the hearing organs. He first discusses if the hearing organ is the same as the ear, which only some hearing creatures have. He searches for something similarly differentiated as the pupil for sight. In doing so, he makes the implicit assumption that the external senses can be seen analogously. In this paragraph, he does not name any reference authors. He does so only rarely, as in the following explanations. Nevertheless, it can be argued that Gesner does not follow the reasoning of Aristotle, but that of the physician Claudius Galenus as of antiquity and the contemporary Andreas Vesalius, whose work is based on anatomical models. Even though Aristotle does not dominate the argument, his influences can be seen in the choice of subchapters and loci and the framework of the argumentation. The table makes this clear. Gesner places it as at the beginning before he treats the individual senses. His table is the abridged version of the introduction to Aristotle's De Anima by Jakob Faber Stapulensis. Similar, though not identical, categories are constructed and explained precisely in the following order: potentia, object, mode of operation, organ, and stage of life, cardus vivendi. Gesner deviates from this usual path by putting the anatomical discussion of the organ at the beginning of his line of reasoning and examining the topic of hearing from a different perspective, the evidence of the human and animal skeletons. The appearance of the dissected body in this research has a clear priority over the classical authors and creates the basis of argumentation. It can be linked to the verbal illustration that stem from Aristotle and other classical authors such as Virgil. To cite only one of these examples, Aurelius Augustinus recorded himself to have known someone who was able to move his ears back and forth. Gesner took these quotes from collected volumes and encyclopedias published in the Middle Ages and his own time, including the work of a contemporary, Caelius Rhodiginus, who cited Virgil on hearing. He also used the 10th century dictionary entitled Suidas, which contained 30,000 terms and presents Greek next to Latin names. A very short comparison will now be undertaken to introduce the tradition of De Anima treatises and show that Gesner's work is structured in a different way. The 10th chapter of Gregor Reisch's Margarita Philosophica, a school compendium of the complete knowledge of the Artes Liberales up to the Aristotelian Physica, stems from 1504 and treats the vegetative and sensory abilities of the soul. In the 15th subchapter, Reisch devotes a few sentences to the ear. This work is arranged differently from Gesner's, and for teaching purposes, takes the form of a dialogue between a fictive magister or teacher and his student. The student poses a question and the teacher answers it. Two authors serve as references for the ear, the philosopher Aristotle in one place and Boethius in his treatise about music. Gesner keeps the Aristotelian structure, which separates the superordinate concepts of object, the sound, organ, the ear and medium, air or water. However, he copies it from a source that is much closer to Aristotle, that is, the Scholia commentary of Faber Stapulensis. Reisch places hearing second in his text about the external senses, since he declares both hearing as well as seeing the first place sense as the most necessary for learning. This is the difference between Reisch and Gesner as well. Gesner starts with the tactile sense. He also takes a different approach from Reisch when he describes the organ. In his opinion, the ear cannot be the organ of hearing because some animals do not have ears. The ability to hear is connected to the bone and the ear. Since Reisch had already mentioned this, Gesner's statement is a repetition. However, it gives a much more precise formulation, spiced with the inside knowledge and curiosity of a professional physician. The idea of a sermon of comparisons between sound and speech, which both involve lists of antonyms and which Gesner has, is not present in Reisch's work. An initial result of this analysis is that the anima is not a dialogue for teaching purposes, but is divided into superordinate concepts and statements with subordinate lists of topics. The second part of Gesner's De Anima, which is treated here, does not provide direct lists of author references, but includes references to different authors concerning short arguments or single sentences, like the one with Augustinus. Its structure characterizes the book as a collection of loci, but it is not consistently dedicated to one sort of loci like Pandecta. The book does not refer to Petrus Ramus' method. Even with its lists and categories, the book displays a coherent argumentation of thoughts. A second result of this research is that the text would be comprehensible without a parallel reading of one of the original classical texts, but it cites other works by name. However, as far as Aristotle goes, this work can be read in much the same way as the contemporary work of Melanchthon, as separate from the original and with an important focus to questions that lead through the text. It is therefore not a work of Scholia in the sense that it explains the terms of the Aristotelian text with a direct aid or limit of limiter quotes. Such an Aristotelian text served as a basis, that is, the one by Faber Stapulensis. With the idea of repetition, Gesner avoids a discussion of teaching method without diminishing the value of the book for instruction. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Anya. Now, I think we have some opportunity for questions. I have to say I was intrigued by some of the illustrations at the end. I was hoping you were going to get to those too. Can you tell us anything about them?
Well, we can go a little bit further than that.
Yeah.
So, well, I have a little bit. This paper was a little bit longer, so I cut the end. And what you see here is are two illustrations of Gesner's book on fish, mm-hmm. or on
marine life.
Yeah, it's not really fish. And we can make a little discussion. What you see, mm-hmm. you see here clearly something that is built from the bone. It's like the dolphin, mm-hmm. and he copied that. He was a big copier, actually. He copied that directly from Ron Velasquez, mm-hmm. Because he thought it's important for his book, so he just grabbed it and copied it in his own book. And here you see a female dolphin, and this is kind of a small dolphin. Uh-huh. So this is an embryo dolphin. And these pictures are actually made after the living. But the interesting thing is, being Gesner, he could not cut off
any information he got. So if there's an information about a strange animal that somebody has seen, that where there is a witness, where we have a witness for, even if it's Augustine who saw somebody moving his ears, he would have to include it. And so this strange thing here, even though it seems completely unlikely that it exists, is put into the marine life book as well, and is somehow connected to the tuna as a fish. Yes, and the tuna is seen as a very such very well which you can eat.
Yes,
but you can't eat this one.
No,
it's the same. It's this is connected to the tuna, and it's called Tritonus, as you might know.
So the aim of comprehensiveness led him to include stuff, even if there wasn't anything that he personally had seen, but because he wants to be comprehensive, he includes
it. If somebody else has seen it and has given witness, this medieval way of witnessing something. If you have a personal witness, then you can't really exclude it, even if you have never seen it, because he had not... he had no mathematical or physical laws of nature. He was searching for laws, actually, and he divided the space into the animals living on the land and the animals living in the sea, and trying to make here connections or comparison between sea life and life on Earth. And he says life in the sea is so much bigger and more nutritious, but there's always something missing, because even though there are men and women in the sea, they don't have any soul, and they are craving for the Earth's soul. So what you see in the marine life is an incomplete picture of what is on Earth, and that way he's a bit a Neoplatonist to mirror like Earth life into the sea, and then say, yeah, well, it's a kind of picture, but it's incomplete because we don't have the soul, the human soul.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, with regard to the medical information, the ear and so forth, he was quite, had the beginnings of an empirical approach.
Absolutely, yes.
But I'm wondering, with respect to these, was he giving some review of the actual accounts that there were? So he said, well, this thing, this person mentions it, but since then nobody has seen it.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of an empirical sense that maybe we need to look further for this, or this could require further evidence.
He says exactly, or he tries to make exactly clear where he found the reference. Since somehow he takes information that is seen on Earth, he takes it like information that he gets out of books or so, and he just tries to follow the reference. In this case, he says, yes, it's a mythological figure, and we have to be cautious or whatever. I haven't seen it. I don't know if it exists.
So was there some, I understand that there were some associations for some of those bizarre creatures with associations of references in the Bible, Leviathan, and so.
Yeah.
Was he thinking that we have to keep this, there were sort of scriptural interpretation motivations, right?
Yeah.
For keeping those things, because the Bible may be referring to them.
What he does is he has some paragraphs, and he would first give the actual description as an animal, then he would give the cultural surroundings, like where you find it in the Bible, where you find it in Augustinus, and where you find it anywhere else. But I don't think that this is it's a concern, and but I never think that it would occur to him
to try to suppress anything. The only time he suppresses something is when he didn't want his students to read obscene texts, so he had to censor one marshal. Mm-hmm. There he suppresses some things, but not in the object world, where he really tries to get every reference he can.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, do you have a question?
Yeah, back one slide, you have those five results. Back one slide. And I was thinking throughout how physics textbooks are often organized like this, and I expect other sciences too. You know, there's a topic, conservation of energy, conservation of momentum, mm-hmm. and then sub-examples of them. There's a bit of repetition. There's appeals to classical experiments or everyday experiments. And then instead of repetition or instruction, at the end there's a lot of homework problems where you repeat the same concepts. Now Galileo wrote in dialogues for some time. And of course, he was before this. I'm wondering if physical science writings after this started to adopt more of this kind of structure, or if it took longer for this kind of structure to make it into the texts. Galileo was after this. How long did it take then for this kind of structure to make it into physical science instruction?
Let's see. The whole idea of the dialogue that started in medieval times was repeated up to nowadays, even up to today, in catechism. So in the moment that you have a kind of theological-based school, you would always have the dialogue as a form of teaching very present, because the students would learn their catechism that way and not in any other way. And so in the moment that these abridged forms of commentary get into literature, they were copied by a lot of people, and especially in the 16th century, every scholar did their own abridgment, like Theodor Zwinger, who then made a whole new enterprise out of this abridgment, and they used their books for teaching, so they asked the students to buy the books. Usually. I would say that you have, especially in the northern, in the north of Europe, you have this idea of abridged textbooks from the 1530s or 1540s onward. And you find it everywhere. So physics was not something else than rhetoric, or than it's just in an advanced stage of learning, but it's not something completely with a different approach of learning or something.
Other questions, Paul?
Yeah, given that integration of rhetoric and topics, if you will, and given that extensive effort to sort of praise, you know, ways of saying the author is wonderful and this very tasteful and so on, were there little laudatory comments about, and now we turn to the great Aristotle to understand, you know, were there things like that embedded in the text?
He did not try to build a shrine for Aristotle. Mm-hmm. What he always did, because he didn't like that, especially in the Anima, he would always top Aristotle with Galen, because he always comes from that part. Because Galen always goes with the bones of the, he goes with the skeleton mm-hmm. of the animals and of the human beings and whatever. Mm-hmm. And so for him, Aristotle is not the last person to mm-hmm. To ask. Mm-hmm. He just, because he is, he has it in his contract mm-hmm. that he has to teach Aristotelian mm-hmm. physics, mm-hmm. so he would go with the structure, uh-huh. but he would always mm-hmm. give them Galen mm-hmm. And say that is better than Aristotle's because of this.
Oh.
And I don't know if you are familiar with the medicine textbooks. Mm-hmm. There are some medieval abridgments or explanations of Galen that are the so-called canon, which mm-hmm. are taught, for example, in Padua or in medical schools. Mm-hmm. And what he does here, he dismisses these kind of Galen mm-hmm. Abridgments. Or this kind of first Galen abridgment that were made in the 13th century mm-hmm. by doing his own thing and mm-hmm. by comparing Galen and Aristotle. Mm-hmm. That is, I think in that he has a certain kind of innovation, mm-hmm. Innovative talent or so, even though you wouldn't really see it because that is all made in a very traditional way. But in little aspects, mm-hmm. he doesn't follow the tradition.
Any other questions? Jeff?
Well, there's the classic distinction between the fox and the hedgehog. I'm sure you've heard that in knowledge. So, Plato being the ultimate hedgehog who's about doing the one thing, and Aristotle being the fox who goes out and mm-hmm. takes from many sources and kind of brings it together. I mean, Gesner seems like the ultimate fox in that regard. And even you were saying, if he's not building a shrine to Aristotle, mm-hmm. what he's doing is really Aristotelian, in spirit, in many ways, yeah. and also in the Catholicity of his interest. Whereas, he's not about. It's not as much about his organizing principle as Aramis would be, but. Mm-hmm. Just what is Gesner not interested in? There's nothing that he's not interested in. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
what is his? Mm-hmm. What is his? He doesn't have the critical spirit of a Weyer. We're still a couple centuries from Linnaeus. What's the Gesner kind of spin or imprint on this? It doesn't seem like he's, as you've described, he's taking these things from various sources and kind of laying it out there. In, at times, maybe in a little bit of a critical spirit, but what's kind of the distinct Gesner imprint on the knowledge as he presents it, mm-hmm. or is there a distinct just that he his curiosity on it?
Yeah, it's a certain balance between looking for sources in books and mm-hmm. in the world, and in using his senses to get information and to get verification on what he is actually presenting. So he would, that is one of the ultimate things. Mm-hmm. Here you see a very strange diagram that he prepares to show the value of the senses. It's in the lecture scripts that Caspar Wolff has published in 1586, and you see that this is the range of the human skin, mm-hmm. more or less. So this is the human skin, and the tactile sense, mm-hmm. As the first sense, ends there. Mm-hmm. So you would only be able to feel things if they come to your skin. So you would only be able to verify things if they come to your skin. And the same is true with the gusto.
Taste.
Yep. This is olfactory. The
smell.
Smell
yep.
goes a little bit further. Then hearing is already a little bit further still. And the sight has the most range. And by using this
the skin as a kind of organizing thing, and the reach of the senses, he is, I think, trying to bring both together, that is, the world of information and the world of actually, sensing nature or sensing what he is seeing, and he tries to describe that a bit better. Mm-hmm. And so I think there, in searching for this balance, or in being aware that there's something that you have to use a kind of machine like your eye or your taste or so to get information with, I think there lies a bit of something new that comes from him. But it's not never theoretized outside of trying to figure this diagram. And his student, Kaspar Wolf, says of this diagram, this is the only thing that is really new in Gessner.
Oh.
That's what he writes about his teacher. This is what this Gessner is all about. So if you can get a good interpretation of this, then you know like where
Gessner's contribution.
Okay.
Excellent. Well, I think we're going to stop here. If you have more questions, feel free to talk with Anya while she is here. But please join me now in thanking Anya for her presentation. Refreshments, do help yourselves, and thank you so much for coming.
So, here we go. To exit.
The comment about so well written doesn't need an index. It seems.